My trusty Arm & Hammer is bringing out the news. Arm & Hammer baking soda, that's the thing to use.
Safe and pure and gentle,
costs so little too. Arm & Hammer baking soda does so much for you.
Soda does so much in a personal way, especially on hot summer days. Soda bicarbonate in a bathtub of cool water soothes your skin, eases taut muscles, makes you feel like a new woman. And after the bath, dust yourself with soda. It's one of the most effective and safest deodorants you can use. Keep Arm & Hammer baking soda in your bathroom and pamper yourself all summer long.
Nothing else will do so much and cost so little, too. Arm & Hammer baking soda, let it work for you.
Now, a message from the telephone company.
Hello, I'm Max Morant. Play ragtime piano. You know, showbiz. Travel a lot. That means I use long distance a lot. Call ahead for reservations. Call home to talk to my family. Not all showbiz, though. In the summer, we just get in the car and light out. Call ahead for a room. Call friends we want to visit along the way. That's considerate. Smart, too. You get a better dinner when they know you're coming.
The news comes first with Net Alert. Get bulletins, special reports immediately on this CBS radio network station.
This is KNX and KNX FM, 1070 radio in Los Angeles. The time, 10 minutes past 10.
Good morning.
You can put aside whatever you have to do. If you're driving, listen carefully now. Maybe better pull up on the side of the road. I don't want you to get too involved in this thing and wind up bumping into somebody. Because we're going to resume now the discussions we had 2 weeks ago today, remember? With Chan Thomas, the engineer who has spent the last 14 years of his life correlating, if I'm using the right word, Chan, correlating the scientific data from any number of various categories of scientific study, right?
Right.
Including what?
Oh, you can go all the way from oceanography to radiology, anthropology, archaeology. Just about any science that pertains to the planet, which fall into the class of Earth sciences.
And to state the problem, the proposition, not the problem, the proposition succinctly, this correlation of all this data brought you to what? Conclusion stated simply, sir.
Well, we have to go back to men who started the science of geology, like Cuvier and Deluc, who in their studies, their early studies, concluded that the surface of the globe, once every few thousand years, they couldn't exactly say how often, took an odd lurch or revolution in an odd direction, and just about wiping everything out completely. And in Cuvier's words, the challenge was to find the cause of these events. And all I've done really is to pick up the chase where they left off, which had not evidently been picked up since their time successfully. And first, the effort was to either verify or refute the concept once and for all. Put it to bed if it's wrong, or see if it's right. And the best way would be to correlate the data, the known accepted data from the various earth sciences, to see whether the picture was verified or refuted. And it really verified the picture. There's enough data in each science to indicate that, well, maybe these things happen. But not enough to conclude it. But once you correlate between sciences, then the picture becomes irrefutable. So then the next track was, all right, so what happens? What's the process? What is it that happens? And third, find the trigger. And that was the biggest chase of all.
All right. Now, joining us today in our discussions is the young gentleman who teaches geology at Queens College in New York, Dr. Carl Seifert, do I pronounce it correctly,
That's
sir?
That's
correct. Seifert, Dr. Carl Seifert, Jr., who received his Ph.D. in geology from Stanford in California and has a B.A. in geology from Vanderbilt University in Nashville, Tennessee. Teaching at Queens College, inspired by your father, is that right, sir?
Right.
He, too, was a professor.
Right, at Vanderbilt University in Nashville.
I see. And your specialty is?
Structural geology.
That structural geology.
That would be the study of faults and folds, deformation within the Earth's crust. It's closely allied with what Mr. Thomas has been talking about.
Are you acquainted with these things of which Chan Thomas is talking?
I've read through his book, and I listened to the tape of the broadcast.
Did you? Now, would you be so kind as to tell me where you stand on the subject? What do you think about it?
Well, I'm afraid I'll have to stand in opposition to him all that I have been taught, all that I have observed, doesn't agree with this idea that the Earth's crust has shifted very rapidly. However, there is some good geological evidence which indicates that the Earth's crust has shifted, but at a much, much slower rate. The rate which Mr. Thomas suggested is, he suggested that it was something like an 80-degree shift in the Earth's crust, which occurred somewhere around between 6 and 12 hours. Whole shift occurred in 6 and 12 hours. And I did a few calculations on this and found that this would require an average rate of speed of shift of the Earth's crust of some 465 miles an hour if the Earth were to shift in 12 hours, or 930 miles an hour if the shift were in 6 hours. Of course, this is exceeding the speed of sound even. And this sounds pretty fantastic. What sort of mechanism could possibly drive something this rapidly?
Well, so may I ask this. Do you or do you not agree with Chan Thomas that the Earth's crust rests on a 60 miles down, 60 mile deep of molten?
Well, again, there I'll have to disagree, at least in part, in that the evidence from earthquake waves indicates that this material is solid. Now, Mr. Thomas stated that this is liquid which acts as a solid, and I would say that it's a solid which often will act as a liquid. Not really a liquid, but perhaps better some sort of plastic, or in effect a very viscous liquid.
Yes.
But yielding to stresses under a very long time, rock can flow, even though it's solid.
Mm-hmm. You couldn't conceive of it then as supporting a theory where we had a quick shift of the Earth's crust around.
The main point where we differ is in the speed of the shift, rather than whether or not a shift occurred. The geological evidence suggests that there has been a shift of about 90 degrees in 600 million years. And the rate of speed of this would be just a bare fraction of a mile per hour, or something like about a half an inch per year would be the rate of speed that the geological evidence suggests.
Well, that is a good point of difference. Chan, what's your answer to that?
Well, now, here you have evidence of the two schools of geology, where Dr. Seifert is talking about what is known as the uniformitarian school of geology. And this is what the evidence offers up as a normal process of the Earth aging process. But I'd like to go to what I said about correlation of data between sciences. And I actually, to study this molten layer, which I say is 60 miles down, went back to the works of the seismologist Gutenberg, who in 1924, from his seismological records, did you ever see a seismological record? It's a real mishmash of curves. Honestly, to me, it's a credit to the profession that they can deduce the information mathematically that they do about the inner structure of the Earth from such a mess of waves on a piece of paper, from earthquake information. But Gutenberg, Benno Gutenberg, who at the time was the head of the Caltech Seismological Labs, said that he suspected that this layer existed at those depths, 60 to 120 miles down. I think his work was tremendous in doing this. Now, in our first subsurface nuclear shots in the Nevada Flats in 1958, the seismologists were given their first decent wave to work with on a piece of paper, because a nuclear shot below the ground gives a nice sharp leading-edge pulse. And they know when it's going to come, it's controlled in time, and they make a nice record of this. And it gave them better information on shallow data. This is shallow data at that depth than they'd ever had before. And the conclusion was, yes, there's something there, all right. There's a real controversy going on between the Honolulu seismologists and the Caltech seismologists about this, because the Honolulu seismologists say it's a molten. And the Caltech seismologists say, oh, it's plastic, near solid. And the Honolulu seismologists say, well, it supplies all of the volcanoes with the molten stuff they spew forth. Well, now if we go to oceanography, we get a better picture. Because the IGY data from oceanography says that oceans all over the world, there is no place that escapes this. When they reach high tide, they're only 7/10 as high as they should be. Because the increase in depth of the water says that the height of the water should increase a certain number of feet. But it only increases 7/10 of that amount, which means the bottom has to squeeze the earth in that much. And the only way for it to do that is to have a something down there that's soft enough to have to squeeze the ocean floor down that much. Which means that this probability of this molten layer existing the world over is much higher than we think, especially as provided by the data from oceanography. And geologists aren't looking at oceanography too much, so they haven't really correlated this data into their geological information.
Had you heard that, Dr. Seifert?
I'm not familiar with this, but if I could, I'd like to comment on the work of Gutenberg. As I understand his work, what he discovered was not a liquid layer, but a layer which was has been termed the low-velocity layer in the Earth's crust, which is some 60 miles to 150 miles or so deep. And this layer is the layer which behaves as a very, very viscous liquid, but it is in reality solid, but so near its melting point that it can yield under long-term stresses. Now, the problem about where volcanoes originate is a very interesting problem. In Hawaii, they know that the depth of origin of the volcanoes is some 30 miles or so. They determined this by studying earthquakes which preceded volcanic eruptions. And they found that earthquakes started at this depth. They became shallower and shallower as the molten lava rose in the toward the volcano and actually probably fractured the rock as it moved upward. The volcano began to swell as the lava began to feed into the magma chamber beneath the volcano. They can measure this with very sensitive tilt meters. And just very shortly after the volcano swells, there often is an eruption. Not always, but often an eruption. So they can know the depth then from which these from which this lava originates. Now, the density of the material at this depth is, we know from the study of earthquake waves, is about a little under 3.5 times the density of water. Now, this density is too great to be basalt, which is the material which is erupted. So it must be a material which is more dense than basalt. And we postulate that this layer is peridotite, which is a material quite a bit more dense than basalt, and that partial melting of this is what gives the basalt. Now, this is one of the theories, and people will not all geologists will go along with this theory, but this is, I would say, the currently accepted theory for the origin of the of the lava from the on the Hawaiian Islands.
You know, it's so fascinating to a layman is that I've always thought that this geology was just 2 and 2 makes 4 and everybody knew. But you all have a lot of fun arguing these things, don't you? Huh? Well, this is great.
There's something else involved here in these volcanoes that he hasn't mentioned, and that is the Japanese work in studying volcanoes from an electrical point of view. In other words, they've studied the electrical storms within a volcano by measuring the voltage across a volcano in the ground during eruptions, and they found out that this is a fantastic electrical storm going on, and they postulate that it appears to be more of a planetary version of a sunspot than anything we could imagine, that there's much more than just pressure involved here, that there are magnetic and electrical storms inside the Earth going on that are pretty fantastic.
The other day, you were telling me, Chan, that somebody found an artifact, and I have played with that word since you taught me what it meant. I didn't know. Somebody found an artifact in a vein of coal, if my memory serves me, some 30 million years old. Now, and you also mentioned the fact that you thought that oil fields being animal fossils must have come from whole bunches of animals that were instantly killed or something all in one place, and later we got this oil. Now, these things these are some of the things you use to support your theory that this 80-degree shift must have taken place very quickly, rather than the half-inch, a century that you're talking about?
Half an inch per year.
Half an inch per year that the doctor's talking about. Do you know anything, Dr. Seifert, about these artifacts that have been found down there?
I would like to know the source from which you...
It was a newspaper article, which I read about a year ago. Which related this, and it was on the radio and the news items. It was quite a sensational thing about a year ago. I went back to my files and tried to find this thing. I haven't been able to find it yet. I was told by somebody, one of my scientist friends who read it, that I might have made an error of a factor of 10. It could be 3 million, not 30 million, but it's either 3 or 30 million, as my memory serves me. But it's up in the millions of years to where... it makes a difference. I wonder if I could answer one more thing that Dr. Seifert said here about this slow-moving process. I'd like to go to one of the men who, to me, is one of the greatest Americans living today, professor of archaeology at the University of New Mexico, Dr. Carl Hibben, who wrote the book The Lost Americans. And Frank C. Hibben, pardon me. Dr. Frank C. Hibben, The Lost Americans, is published, it's in Apollo edition paperback now. He spent time following the gold mining operations up in Alaska. And with his own eyes, he saw these things where he says there were literally trainload lots of animals, a plethora of tropical life, all the way from mastodons and tigers, lions, zebras, hyenas, every tropical animal you could imagine, blown across the countryside, including Taylor's bison, which is an extinct variety, shredded to pieces by supersonic winds, burned by some lava eruption, buried under this fantastic alluvial deposit of mud, and the whole works frozen, solid. And not just one little place. I mean, this goes across Siberia and into Alaska. And the only reason we've discovered or uncovered these things is that the gold is in the gravel below this layer. So they have to go through it to get at the gold. And his challenge to me is a very interesting challenge because he, in his own way, reissued Cuvier's challenge. He said, this is one of the most consuming mysteries in the world of science. And if you're going to answer a mystery like this, it's a thriller, a murder thriller, really. Is what he said. If you're going to answer this, you must satisfy all of the facts. Not just some. All. And the only way to satisfy all of these facts is to go across the board in all the sciences. And to me, this is one of the errors involved here in naming this cataclysmic geology. It's not really geology as such. You might even call it cataclysmology if you want to. But this suddenness of freezing... And in all of the engineering laws of what it takes to freeze meat and preserve it like this is what gives us the clue of the time and element involved.
I'd like to...
Can you hold that just a minute, Doctor, now? Because I do have to make one little commercial here. Then we do a station break, and then we shall resume this very interesting discussion. Hold it one second. Please hold your thoughts, sir. Our sponsor is Kerr. Kerr Mason jars, caps, and lids, which are as perfect for home freezing as they are for home canning. And they make a very wide mouth jar, too, which is marvelous for freezing whole chickens or canning whole tomatoes, those great big ones that'll soon be on the market. Last year, more Kerr lids were sold than any other brand, and they're continuing to increase in popularity. You know why? They sell better because they seal better. That's Kerr. Now let's take a station break, and we shall be right back.
This is the CBS Radio Network.
This is KNX and KNX FM, 1070 Radio, Los Angeles. When all is said and done, what do you really want for your savings?
I want to save with the largest, who gives you the most with 4.85% interest.
American Savings is the largest savings and loan association in all the nation, offering you all three benefits for your savings.
First, your funds earn interest from the date received when held to quarter's end. You can earn up to 21 days extra interest any month.
Second, we compound interest daily. You earn interest on interest every day. Our 4.85% current annual rate actually amounts to 4.97% on funds held 1 year.
Third, you earn interest to date of withdrawal no matter when you take savings out of your account on funds held for 6 months or more.
We call it daily, daily interest. Why take less?
Free gifts, favors for children, refreshments during open house at all 17 offices of American Savings.
Monday, July 12th, Arthur Godfrey time resumes with a continuation of a fascinating discussion on cataclysmic upheavals and geology with Chan Thomas, author of The Adam and Eve Story, about which we had quite a session here a couple of weeks ago, and the professor of geology at Queens College in New York, Dr. Carl Seifert, Jr., who was about to speak when I interrupted him for the station break. What were you going to say, Dr. Seifert?
Well, this there is a great mystery in geology about how exactly were large mammoths preserved. We find up in Siberia, in Alaska, preserved whole, in a very few instances, whole mammoths, which apparently were must have been frozen very rapidly, or at least according to some accounts. And there's an article which I thought that you might bring up this, so I took the liberty of looking up this article by William R. Ferrand in the 17th March 1961 edition of Science, and he answers these objections to this catastrophic freezing of these mammoths by suggesting that, for one thing, that these mammoths were not the meat in the mammoths was not fresh, that apparently only dogs would eat this, and the meat was rather putrid, so that apparently before freezing these animals had gone through some state of decay. And that another objection is that they only find these frozen animals, they only find the large ones. The two examples given are the mammoth, which is related to the elephant, had long hair and such in order to protect himself from the cold. The other animal was the woolly rhinoceros, which was also a very large and cumbersome animal. And they suggest that what happened to these animals was that perhaps they died probably through a variety of causes, but perhaps were, at least some of these were asphyxiated in caught in some sort of perhaps a mud flow. And in fact, there is some indication, such as the fact that apparently some of these animals had a great amount of blood rushed to their head, which according to him suggests that these they did die by asphyxiation. Now, the fact that only the large, cumbersome animals were found frozen suggests that that there was no great universal dying of these animals, but rather just the large animals who could perhaps not free themselves from mud flows and this type of thing. You have any comment on that?
Well, first of all, the information in his that Ferrand had to work on is evidently quite limited, because there were not just the large animals found. Dr. Hibbins' explorations in Alaska showed that that was not so, that they found a plethora of all kinds of animals, from soup to nuts, including baby elephants and baby mammoths, frozen intact. I think, too, that Ferrand ignored some of the facts here where, for instance, the knowledge that over the past four centuries, literally thousands of mammoth tusks have been shipped out of northern Siberia, dug up from the frozen tundra, and these ivory tusks were preserved in this frozen tundra. But also the fact that the meat was putrid is not so important as the fact that the fibrous structure of the meat was maintained. Now, biologist Ivan T. Sanderson, whose article in the February 16th, 1960 issue of Saturday Evening Post is ridiculed by Ferrand in this article, Sanderson approached this to me from a very intelligent point of view. He went to the American Institute of Frozen Foods and said, all right, if you're going to freeze meat, what are the problems involved? And anybody who has a home freezer knows that if you freeze a quarter of a half of beef, you've got a real problem to freeze that meat fast enough to prevent the water content of the meat from crystallizing with large enough crystals that will destroy the fibrous structure of the meat so that when you defrost it, it's a mass of goo and you can't cook it. It's just worthless. Well, they know this, that this one particular mammoth, which was subjected to a very thorough study, the Berezovka mammoth, was frozen fast enough to where even the lining of the wall of his stomach did not lose its fibrous structure. When it was defrosted, it may have been defrosted slowly, which gave it a chance to putrefy a little, but the fibrous structure was maintained, which meant that the original freezing was fast enough. So Sanderson said to the American Frozen Foods Institute, what does it take to freeze a whole mammoth like this? And they researched the problem and came back with the answer, it's impossible. There's absolutely no known way in man's technology or in nature to do this. And we must remember also that this beast and all the beasts that Hibben speaks of in Alaska were frozen not only by themselves, but the layer of mud they were in was frozen too. A fantastic transfer of heat from inside a beast out. Now, the American Frozen Foods Institute said that in order to freeze a beast like this, you have to lower his temperature about 140 degrees Fahrenheit from his normal temperature. And you have to do it, I guess you have an outside time to do it in 4 hours, absolute outside, more like maybe 2 to 3 hours. And you've got to have what science calls an infinite heat sink or an infinite supply of cold to remove this heat. And moreover, you've got to maintain that temperature for thousands of years for him to be found as he was found. Now, this business of the hairy animals and the woolly mammoth and all that, being the wool being assumed as being part of the animal to protect him against the cold of the Arctic, if that's the case, we should go to Central Africa and take all the great big hairy gorillas and move them out of there because it's tropical there. get them away from the heat. The point being that all these animals that have been found, large, small, and as Hibben puts it, in literally in trainload lots of thousands of frozen animals, there is not enough fauna or vegetable life up there to support what they need to support their life or needed in that time.
In this copy of the book you have given me,
yes,
Chan, you pointed out a paragraph I'd like to read. Every time the cataclysmic concept has come to life, the beast, speaking of the concept, has been stoned, burned at the stake, beaten to a pulp, and laid to rest time after time. But the corpse simply won't stay dead. Each time it raises the lid of its coffin and says in sepulchral tones, you will die before I. May I ask Dr. Seifert, geology, that is, formal geology as taught in our universities, just doesn't go along with this concept at all, eh?
Well, as a matter of historical interest, this is sometimes mentioned, but this theory of these cataclysms was proposed before we knew very many geological facts, and we've just simply evolved, as it were, away from this, and most things which most geological observations can be explained by processes which we see today, very slow processes which occur over millions of years. I'd like to point out something which might bear on this problem, because there is a way, a method of determining where the ancient poles were. Now, if the Earth had shifted on its axis by the amount very rapidly, the axis of rotation, if the Earth's crust had shifted, the axis of rotation would remain constant. And we should have evidence of this in the rocks. Now, as an example of this, if we have a lava flow, which is flowing out on the surface of the ground, as this lava crystallizes, certain minerals, such as magnetite, acquire magnetism. In other words, they behave like a magnet, and the and this orientation to this magnetic field within this rock is oriented parallel to the Earth's magnetic field at the time when this rock cooled. So we have a way now of determining the position of the ancient magnetic field, because since this means really that rocks behave like a magnet. We simply measure the orientation of the magnetic field within the rock, and we have an idea of where the poles were at the time of crystallization of the rock. And in a sedimentary rock, such as a sandstone, the same thing holds true. Little grains of magnetite orient themselves parallel. Now, if we take rocks and measure the position of the of these magnetic poles, we find that over the past, 25 million years or so, the poles are very close to the present Earth's rotational pole. In other words, there's no indication of any crustal shift over the past 25 million years. Otherwise, we would expect some of the rocks to acquire a magnetism which was oriented along more or less along the equator, where this shift occurred.
Yes, yes. What do you say to that, Jan?
Well, the information that I read on this subject shows that when a lava bed is formed, of course, the atoms of iron align themselves with magnetic north, and as the bed cools, the atoms then indicate where north was when that bed was formed. And there are indications that, and much more recently than 25 million years ago, as a matter of fact, Hibben in his book says that geologists are reckless with time. I agree with him. I think they are. But he says the indications are that Antarctica was at the North Pole at one time, and in much more recent times than uniformitarian geology would care to agree, other areas have been at the North Pole. I'd like to go.
This Antarctica at the North Pole rather than the South Pole, I think, mm-hmm. is probably a result of what we call a reversal in the magnetic field.
That's only a theory. You see, as Hibben says, you must answer all of the facts. This is only one fact which you can satisfy by saying the field was reversed, but you must ignore other facts to do so.
Such as?
Such as the frozen animals, and such as the fact that 6,500 years ago to 7,000 years ago, the oceans, according to oceanographic data, all over the world, took a sudden rise of about 200 feet or so. And there's only one way to do this that we know, and that's melt all of the ice caps.
Right. There was a period of glaciation, which ended about that time.
Now what do you... The explanation of the end of this period of glaciation has not been satisfactory up to now.
Well, this is, a problem in geology which is under debate.
Well, this, to my way of thinking, the answer cannot be found in any one science. And this is why geology, no reflection upon geology, has not found the answer yet, because you have to go to so many other sciences.
We may have found the answer. Just because it's in debate, just because people argue one way or the other, doesn't mean we haven't found the answer yet.
What are the answers that are in debate now?
Well, some people... the real problem here, just because people argue one way or the other, doesn't mean we haven't found the answer yet.
What are the answers that are in debate now?
Well, some people... the real problem here is what brought on the glaciation.
Yes.
We know that geological evidence indicates that there have been at least four separate periods of glaciation. We're right now in an interglacial period. Presumably, if nothing else changes, we'll get another glaciation. And the question is, what brought on this glaciation? Why did the ice sheets cover much of North America, much of Europe and Asia? And what caused the ice to melt and then form again and then melt? Some of the theories that have been suggested are a change in the radiation from the sun. Another theory is that the Arctic Ocean, this, as a matter of fact, this theory was is written up in the Reader's Digest. I don't recall just when, but the Arctic Ocean perhaps at one time was free of ice. Of course, now today we have the ice covers approximately, covers much of the Arctic Ocean, and the thickness of it is about 10 or 15 feet thick. But if this ice were to melt, just this 10 or 15 feet thick ice, the entire northern regions would be exposed to a much greater amount of precipitation, because the we have a greater surface exposed to evaporation in the northern latitudes.
But what would have caused it to melt?
Well, this is what is thought to have brought on a glaciation. A greater precipitation means more snow during the winters, and more snow. Now, what caused it to melt is thought to be the freezing of the Arctic Ocean. If the Arctic, if we had glaciers formed, of course, the whole surface of the Earth, the average temperature would be lowered. If the average temperature is lowered, then sooner or later, the entire Arctic Ocean will freeze again. If it freezes, then there's less surface for evaporation, and the glaciers are thought to melt back slowly. Now, this is just a pure theory. We don't really know, but there are a number of possible explanations, and perhaps we haven't found the proper one.
But geology does not save room for this explanation.
There is no, as far as I can see, there's nothing which cannot be explained by other means. I'm perfectly willing to listen to evidence which cannot be explained in other ways. But the evidence from paleomagnetism, which is this what I was telling you about, the fact that the rocks behave as a magnet, shows that almost irrefutably that the Earth's crust has not shifted by any amount in the past 25 million years.
Now, you keep shaking your head, Chan. What you got in it?
Well, we're just arguing now what we've read, because I've read different articles that say it does show there have been shifts, and the magnetic north has been all over the place and within the last 25 million years. So what we say here is really meaningless till we get outside and get our papers and compare them with each other in this kind of a debate. I do say, too, that this matter of advancing and retreating ice as a concept of glaciation is not necessarily correct, because this sudden rise of the oceans of 200 feet, which is measured by oceanographers as of about 7,000 years ago, can be accomplished only by melting all of the ice caps. Now, we talk about this Arctic Ocean ice cap of a few feet thick. There are 670,000 cubic miles of ice on Greenland, and about 92.7 million... A million cubic... It's 2.7... I've forgotten the number. A million cubic miles of ice on Antarctica. So that little shell of ice on the Arctic Ocean is almost meaningless with respect to the oceans. In order to raise the oceans today, 200 feet, we've got to melt all of the ice on Greenland and Antarctica, and over 95% of the world's ice is on Antarctica. Well, and there's only one way to melt all that ice, and that's move them to the equator.
Well, this is true, except, I don't know about the equator, but it is true that we could not get a very significant rise in sea level, perhaps 100 feet or so, if we were to melt all the ice. However, evidence indicates that, and I'll go into the evidence, that the ice covered almost all of Canada, a vast ice sheet, which was up to a mile or so in thickness, covered almost all of Canada and extended down to approximately the Ohio and Missouri rivers. And the melting of this amount of ice, plus the ice in Europe and Asia, is what caused the rise in sea level. The melting of the Arctic ice, it wouldn't raise the ice level of sea at all. But the melting of this vast ice sheet. Now, the evidence of this ice sheet, which covered this area, is there are a great number of different lines of evidence. In the New York area, we see Long Island as a terminal moraine. In other words, it's the end of a glacier, where the great amount of debris brought down from Canada, from New England, was simply dumped and left as a ridge, which now forms Long Island. We see along the Ohio and Missouri rivers, we see similar ridges of debris brought by the glacier. And we see scratches, striations, grooves in the rock in New York City and much of the area where pebbles and boulders frozen into the ice moved across the bedrock and dug deep scratches in them.
Mm-hmm. Jan, a question comes to a lay mind now. Supposing that such a thing as you talk about did happen, and all of that ice was melted, and if it did happen and we moved, the Earth's surface moved 80 degrees, mm-hmm. then all of that which was in torrid equatorial zone is now in the North Pole, we'll say, or the South Pole. And wouldn't that freeze and compensate for all of that which was being melted at the poles?
It would freeze, but you see, first of all, the ice caps are formed gradually over a period of time. The particular ice cap that Dr. Seifert talked about did not end with the last rise of the ocean waters. It ended 11,500 years ago with the end of the glaciation in Canada. The Laurentian ice cap, which was 4.5 million square miles in area and created the Laurentian Basin by its pressure, almost the same dimensions as the size of the Antarctic ice cap today. And it was, the Antarctic ice cap is about 2 miles thick in most places. So you have this little difference here of what we're talking about, because I'm talking about 6,500 years ago or 7,000 years ago. It had nothing to do with what happened in Canada, which Dr. Seifert mentioned. By the radiocarbon dating in Wisconsin, that ice cap came to an abrupt end about 11,500 years ago.
Well, you were talking about a 200-foot rise in water.
Right.
6,000 years or 7,000 years.
Right, and that was not due to any end of any ice cap on this continent.
What evidence have we of that?
Well, you take the Niagara Falls gorge. There's a gorge below the falls, and this gorge is about 7 miles long. And we know today that the breakaway of the falls per year averages about 4 to 4.5 feet per year.
Mm-hmm.
They've kept a record of this, I guess, for the past 100, 140 years. And that this is actually how the gorge was formed. Since the falls were born when there was no gorge, they've gradually crept back with their breakaway. We know also that the breakaway of the falls at the outset, when they started, was faster because the water over the falls was deeper, much deeper. It was about 5.5 to 6.5 feet per year average at that time. And that calculates out as for the age of this gorge at about 6,500 to 7,000 years. And the same thing with the gorge below St. Anthony's Falls in the Mississippi River in Minnesota. And this 7,000-year figure, 6,500 to 7,000-year, crops up all over the world. Now, in answer to Arthur's question here about the torrid zone moving to the polar zones, by this concept of these cataclysms or tumbles or whatever you want to call them, the equator tilts so that there are two points opposite each other on the equator, which actually remain on the equator and serve as pivot points.
Mm-hmm.
And the other 90 degrees away from that, the equator does move into polar zones. And of course, the area that moves into a polar zone does not have an ice cap on it. All the land and mud and everything freezes there. And down in Antarctica, you can find stratifications of frozen mud that are just... I've seen pictures of them in National Geographic magazine. They're fantastic. And they've also found frozen giant tropical ferns on the Queen Maud Range in Antarctica.
The age of those ferns, though, I believe, is Permian, which would put them somewhere around 250 million years old.
Well, here again, there's a difference, because the scientists who came back said they appeared to be about 10,000 years old, frozen and not even wilted.
Well, maybe they have different to be ferns that I'm talking about.
Well, there are ferns they found on the rocks, which, yes, would be geologically old. But no, these are ferns on top of the ground, tropical ferns, frozen and not wilted. You have to quick freeze them to do that.
You know what it begins to look like to me? You get a bunch of dedicated scientists, and they get going, or sometimes singly, man working alone. He goes out and dedicates his life, or they dedicate their lives or years of it to a study of this thing. And they come back with data, and this one comes from this part of the world, this one comes from this part of the world, this one comes from this part of the world, they're 25 and 30 years apart. Now a guy comes along and correlates all this stuff, draws this conclusion, and the professor here draws other conclusions. Seems to me this is going to go on and on and on, this debate. Is anybody ever going to come up with the proper answer to this business?
My concept, Arthur, is that actually there is a room for a marriage of the two schools of geology, or if you want to call them that, uniformitarian geology and cataclysmic geology. They belong, they supplement each other. They complement each other, whatever you want to call it. And that the two are really incomplete without each other. And this is really, to me, there's nothing wrong about uniformitarianism, because it happens between each tumble. This aging process of the Earth goes on, just as the concept says. But this sudden interruption in between is so quick and changes everything so fast that it leaves very meager data within each science. And this is why actually it escapes the research work within geology itself. And you need the data from other sciences to bring it out.
And you're not going to be moved from that cataclysmic theory, and you're not going to be moved into it, are you?
I would just like to go back to this thing of paleomagnetism, because this is an area where we have concrete evidence of where the poles were located. I would like to know why the rocks don't record this.
All right. Then I'll talk about the articles I've read. Now, all over the world, you have these formations, these geological formations where there is a basin surrounded by a ridge. And you can think of the Bering Sea basin surrounded by the Aleutian Islands and which join the Russian Kormandorsky chain at the other end. You can think of the Sea of Okhotsk off of Siberia with its island chain, and the Sea of Japan with a Japanese island chain. All circular islands, and the Java-Sumatra area with those curved island chains. And they've uncovered lava beds which indicate magnetic north to be toward those centers or near the centers of those basins, which means that it looks like an ice cap created, the pressure from ice caps created those basins when those areas were at the polar region, and magnetic north would have been within that region at that time.
Have you heard of that, Dr. Seifer?
All the data I have seen indicates that the magnetic pole was up around the present rotational pole. Well, I've seen no pole.
As a navigator...
I'll send you the data, because...
As a navigator, I see on the chart, it says... variation 7 degrees west, change half a degree a year or something like that. Mm-hmm. Is this thing been going on all the time, this movement of the magnetic pole, or does it travel in a circle? Do we ever come back to where we started?
Well, there's a problem here about, of course, the magnetic pole does not coincide with the rotational pole. And this is the reason you get this deflection.
But it's moving all the time.
It is moving, right. And it's thought that given a long enough period of time, in other words, if you sample rocks over, say, a period of thousands or millions of years, that the average position of the rotational pole will be equal to the average position of the magnetic pole. This is a fundamental assumption that most people make in the field of paleomagnetism.
Well, this has been a most fascinating and interesting hour. It is shot, gentlemen.
Oof.
It just went like that. And if the cataclysmic theory were in effect, we'd be one-fourth of the way around right now. On Dr. Seifert's theory, we haven't moved much in the last hour. But I tell you what we have. We've enjoyed this tremendously, and I'm sure that our audience has too. Dr. Seifert, do you have any publications that you would like to talk about that people could read to advance their knowledge, as we have mentioned for Chan?
No, I'm afraid I don't yet.
You better go to college to find out all this stuff, huh? Okay. Meantime, Chan, there's still copies available of yours if folks would like it.
Right, a brand new printing is just coming off the presses now.
Okay. All righty. I thank you, gentlemen, so much. Very, very much for your presence here today, Dr. Carl Seifert, Jr. of Queens College, and Chan Thomas, the author of Adam and Eve's Story. And we'll see you tomorrow, be the good Lord willing.
Today's interview was edited to conform to time requirements. This is the CBS Radio Network.
This is KNX and KNX FM, 1070 Radio, Los Angeles. What's better on a day like today than chicken and dumplings? Ralph's has the fixings. You do the mixing. Ralph's One Day Fresh, tender and meaty, whole stewing chickens are just 19 cents a pound. And for the dumplings, Pillsbury Buttermilk Biscuits or Ballard Sweet Milk Biscuits, 8-ounce cans, 3 for just 19 cents. Now for dessert. There's nothing better than Ralph's Ice Cream. Richly satisfying, cool and refreshing, Ralph's ice creams are a perfect blend of rich, sweet cream and exotic flavors. Now Ralph's catering ice cream, only 69 cents a half gallon. And for the budget-minded, Ralph's old-fashioned ice cream, just 49 cents a half gallon. Other first-of-the-week Ralph's specials include Bordeaux grapefruit, 1-pound can, only 21 cents. And Kleenex facial tissues, 5 packages of 400 count, just a dollar. From Ralph's Fancy Fresh Produce, fresh, crisp lettuce, 2 heads, only 19 cents. And sweet Italian red salad onions, 3 pounds, just 25 cents. Always shop at Ralph's for the most of the best for the least. Ralph's, the family food stores. KNX time, 11 o'clock.